Welcome to episode 66 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And today I am talking to Alan McPherson, who is professor of history and director of the Center for the Study of Force and Diplomacy at Temple University. He's published a ton on U.S. Latin American relations, the history of U.S. Latin American relations, especially as it relates to intervention. And today we're going to be talking about his brand new book, Ghosts of Sheridan Circle, How a Washington Assassination Brought Pinochet's Terror State to Justice. That's actually about assassination that took place September 21st, 1976, so almost exactly 43 years ago. Now, when exactly did the book come out?
The official publication date is actually not passed yet. It's the 21st of September.
Oh, so it's 2019. Also, it comes out even on the exact day.
That's right. It comes out on the 43rd anniversary, although, you know, you've been able to buy it for probably about a month now.
Okay, awesome. Okay, so I always start by asking people how they got interested in studying Latin American politics in the first place.
Well, I came of age sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, and this was, of course, the end of the Cold War. I was interested in politics, but for some reason, I really got interested in Latin America. One reason, I think, is that I was a student activist in Amnesty International, and, of course, human rights violations were rife in Latin America, and so I got to know the politics of the area. And so places like Chile interested in me from the very beginning. But at the same time, it was sort of the end of the war in Nicaragua, and so that was fascinating to me, and I really got interested in U.S. power in sort of the poorest, weakest countries in Latin America, which is Central America and the Caribbean. And so that's what got me going on my grad school career. And then I kept going back to Latin America and learning the language. I took a gap year off of college and spent 3 months in South America learning the language. That's the first time I went to Chile. And so from then on, I was hooked.
Yeah. So a couple things, actually. It makes me your comments made me think about. First is, so you're interested in what's going on in Central America and Chile. What got you toward history rather than, say, a political science or an international studies?
That's a good question. At that point, I didn't want to be a historian. While I was in college, I wanted to be a journalist. And I just thought, well, I need to know a little bit about everything, econ and politics and history. So I was really, I thought maybe even I'd do literature. The more I tried to explain things to sort of understand things, and the more I felt that to me, history was the main way of sort of understanding societies and understanding, what was happening to them. And it was the most fascinating to me at the same time.
Okay. And then the other thing you mentioned was the concept of a gap year, which my niece and nephew grew up in Europe and both were, sort of talking about gap year. And it's so funny how alien that is in the United States, where our universities have become so employment now centric.
Yes.
Like nobody talks about a gap year. That's just completely alien.
That's true. I mean, it certainly was easier back then. I grew up in Canada, and so college was $1,500 a year.
There's that. There is that.
Really cheap. And so it was relatively simple to kind of drop out of college and go back to college. I mean, this was sort of between junior college and real college, so it wasn't really a gap year. It was really just time off. But, I had to work the other 9 months of the year that I wasn't in Latin America just so I could pay to go to Latin America.
Right.
It was really worth it, and I made sure that I went somewhere that I would be interested in going and that it would likely be useful for my future career. So it wasn't really just playing around. And I made sure, of course, that I learned the language.
Right. All right. Well, let's get back to your book. First of all, in your view, does hardly anyone outside academia know about this terrorist attack that happened on U.S. soil? And then you should probably just give a quick background about, what is all this about anyway?
Sure. Well, the assassination was targeting Orlando Letelier. Letelier was the former ambassador of Chile to the United States. So he had lived in Washington And this was during the Salvador Allende years from 1970 to 73. So, of course, Allende, if you know the story, was a Marxist president who was democratically elected and then overthrown in 1973 by Augusto Pinochet, and, you know, which turns into a very repressive right-wing regime. One of the things that Pinochet does eventually is start targeting, you know, what he would call enemies of his regime who live abroad, right? He's already targeted all the people in Chile. Many of them have left. Letelier himself, who was actually, after he was ambassador, he was minister with three portfolios, one after the other. And on the September 11th, on the coup of 1973, he's minister of defense. He gets taken away, taken prisoner, and sent to a concentration camp for a year. It's a terrible ordeal. And then he is let go. He's exiled, eventually to Venezuela, makes his way to Washington. And Pinochet basically tells him, don't do anything against me. We will find you wherever you are, right? And we'll get you. And Letelier says, well, I'm not going to take that very seriously. And, you know, I can't stop being activist against this government. So he, you know, he goes into essentially the NGO sector and becomes an activist. He's in no way violent, in no way breaking laws, but of course he's, you know, breaking the cardinal rule of Pinochet. And he's one of several Pinochet political opponents who will be assassinated abroad, right? Including the biggest ones are Buenos Aires and Rome. And then it happens in Washington on this 21st of September, 76.
Right.
So to get to your question, who knows about this? I mean, certainly at the time it was front page news in the United States, in Chile. I would say a lot of Chileans remember this. Not just the Chileans who sort of followed the story back then, but Chileans who followed any kind of news story up until the 1990s would know this case, because it was really brought to trial against a few Chileans in the mid-1990s, early to mid-1990s. And so it was front page news for months, right? And it would come back and go back again. It was the first live telecast of any court case ever in Chilean history. So it was really sort of the O.J. Simpson case. And in fact, took place at almost exact same time as the O.J. Simpson case. And so it was really big news in Chile. And I've talked to, you know, friends in Chile who are not particularly politically active or knowledgeable. And they go, oh, of course, I know about Letelier. You know, they don't know all the details, but they know the general idea.
Yeah.
I would say another group of people who know are Americans who were alive back then, either because they lived in Washington and it was a big Washington story, or they're somehow in that environment, right? They might be human rights folks. They might be diplomats. I've talked to diplomats who've never had anything to do with Chile, and they remember this case very well. And so, because it happened essentially to a former diplomat, it happened on Embassy Row, right, in Washington. And so the sort of Washington foreign policy community was, you know, really thought that this is one of our own, even though he's a Marxist and a foreigner. And I should add, in the car with him was Ronnie Moffitt, who was a 25-year-old American citizen who died also. And so that was another class of crime that the FBI had to investigate.
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking, though, like your average person, you know, do they know that that a Latin American government conspired to bomb somebody in D.C.? I just sort of wonder whether you get out, at least because you're still describing sort of specialized people. It just seems like such a major story that many Americans in particular don't know anything about.
No, that's true. And frankly, I didn't know about it until, you know, maybe 10 years ago. And I was well into my career at that point. You know, I was teaching U.S. Latin American relations. I knew almost nothing about this. What I did know was that this had happened. These two people had died. It was part of this greater hunt for subversives called Operation Condor. And I taught it as that. And to me, the outcome of it wasn't that important, right? The sort of investigation that followed, I didn't really ask a lot questions about that.
Right.
And I think most people, they figure if they hear something about it, well, it's this thing that happened in the Cold War a long time ago. It's a cold case. It doesn't really matter.
Right. And that kind of segues because there was a lot of attention at the time and a couple of books at the time, and all of those were out of print and kind of disappeared. And so your book is really updating. There's been a lot to update since then. But what inspired you to write the book in the first place?
Well, it's exactly that. I mean, actually, I read this very scholarly book called Reagan and Pinochet. I was interested in just doing something about the Reagan era. And so I was reading all these books about Reagan in Latin America. So I read this book about Reagan and Pinochet, and it's very scholarly and very
good. Morley and McGilliam book?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's very good. You know, it's not the kind of book that I've written. But essentially, it made the case that part of the difficulties between Reagan and Pinochet was this case. The Letelier case was just right in the middle of it, and they could not normalize relations because of this. It was just a thorn in the side of both of these men. And I thought, oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was essentially over after the FBI found a couple people, right, put them in jail. And then I thought, well, it's essentially over. So I said, I thought, well, let me investigate this some more. Then, of course, I realized, as you say, the first books and the only books were published in English in the early 80s, right? 80, 82, you've got two sort of big, you know, best-selling or at least trade publications that come out on this. And they essentially, you know, they're by either journalists or people who knew the Letelieres, and they are giving sort of inside accounts of the investigation, right? The background, right? Who essentially did this, and why would Pinochet do this and his secret police? But it's mostly focused on the investigation by the Justice Department and the FBI, which, right, of course, begins in 76, identifies some, you know, the bombers in 78, and by 1980 has, you know, at least most of them in jail.
Yeah.
But I figured there's so much more to tell after this, you know, once you start reading the sort of news stories and magazine stories and interviews, that the case really continues well into the 1990s until, you know, the book essentially ends in 1995. There's an epilogue, but I mean, the tension is really up there until 1995 because you don't know if these Chileans are eventually going to pay. And you don't know if the widow of Orlando Letelier, who's sort of the main character in the book, whether she will get sort of a full measure of justice for this crime against her husband.
Right. Now, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
No, I was not.
Okay, no. Well, an added twist is that we have a U.S. citizen, Michael Townley. And as an aside, so Michael Townley now is in witness protection. And it amused me to see that in the index in your book under Townley, there is one thing for stupidity of. and we can kind of get back to that. But we have a U.S. citizen who's deeply involved down to planting the car bomb. And that complicates things. But how personally implicated is Augusto Pinochet?
Well, in 2015, the U.S. government released a document in which the CIA, it was a document from the 1980s, in which the CIA had come to the conclusion that Pinochet had very likely ordered the hit, right? Up to then, all the evidence pointed to Manuel Contreras, who was the head of DINA, the secret police. And Contreras had never really pointed the finger at Pinochet. He basically said, all I did because of Pinochet, right? But he never specifically said, Pinochet told me to do this one thing.
Yeah.
But now the CIA pointed to this. And also important is that, you know, but that's the only evidence we have. The CIA is not giving us the evidence that it has to make that conclusion. It just gives us its conclusion. But, you know, you figure, well, if the CIA thinks this, it's probably true.
Yeah.
But also what the CIA said, which is equally important, is that Pinochet was very much the mastermind of the cover-up. So as soon as it does happen, he's the one who tells the guilty Chileans, you know, go to this place, don't say anything, lie about this, lie about that, tries to cover everything up. There are certain Chilean generals who want to admit things, right? Want to maybe punish Contreras by doing this. And Pinochet says, absolutely not. We're going to cover up the whole thing. And so there's a whole chapter in the book called Cover Up that largely deals with this.
Yeah. And then later Contreras says, there's no way I did anything without his orders.
That's correct. He says, everything I did because of the chief, right? At Jefe.
Yeah.
But that's pretty vague.
Also true. Do you think, are there more declassified documents that the U.S. government has not released? What do you think?
I don't think there are more. I think they really made a good faith effort. And in fact, there were two sort of tranches of declassifications in 2015 and then 2016. So in 15, what you got from the CIA was a memo from the Secretary of State, George Shultz, to Reagan saying the CIA just came out with this report. Yeah. And then 2016, we got the CIA report. But it doesn't really add anything more than what Shultz's memo essentially said to Reagan. So we certainly knew that the CIA knew, and Shultz knew, and Reagan knew in 1987.
So getting more to the U.S. or I'm sorry, the U.S. Chilean relations part.
Yeah, and I want to talk about Townley too.
Oh well, then please, yes, because Townley is this sort of sinister character who decides he wants to get involved with not only Chileans but Cuban exiles. So yeah,
right. I mean, I really describe him not as an American but as an American Chilean. You know,
yeah.
I mean, he's born in the States, but his father gets a job with the Ford Corporation and moves the family to Chile. And so he really grows up there and learns the language. He's always got a bit of an accent, looks like an American, but he's sort of their fair-haired boy. Doesn't have much of an education, doesn't get along with his parents, essentially is on his own as a teenager. But he learns electronics and eventually learns to make bombs. And so when the Allende government comes in, and it's a socialist government, it prompts the creation of these sort of guerrilla groups on the right, these sort of paramilitary groups that are, you know, that want to take down the Allende government. And he eventually starts making bombs with them and doing all sorts of other things, and then eventually becomes an assassin, right, through bombs.
Yeah.
So he either arranges assassinations or does them himself, and so he is the key person to ask in the case of Letelier. Plus he's an American and Letelier is in Washington. So the Chileans figure this is the right guy to ask. Now, the great luck of historians is that Townley told his story, and as far as we can tell, it's pretty much all true. And so we have all the details of his conversations with Chileans.
Yeah.
So the conversation he has, and this is where the stupidity comes in, the conversation he has in Chile where he gets his order is from Pedro Espinosa. And Espinosa is the chief of operations at the secret police. So he's gotten his orders from Contreras to find someone to kill Letelier. And he asks Townley, you know, we would like you to go and take care of Letelier. And Townley knows exactly what that means. He's done it before with others. And he says, try to do it quietly, right? Make it seem like an accident, right? Maybe a car accident, but maybe, you know, a mugging in the street that goes awry and somebody gets killed. He says, try to do it in a remote place, a park or something like that, where no innocent people will get killed, and make sure that he's alone in the car. Now, so all of this, you know, is banking on the fact that, you know, Townley's going to listen to him. And Townley says, well, I don't really stab people or shoot people. I make bombs, right? And I put them in places. And he goes, well, do you really have to make a bomb? He goes, yeah, I don't really do anything else. And he goes, well, okay, then just make a bomb, you know? And that's a terrible thing to say. I mean, it would be so easy to find anyone to want to assassinate Letelier, you know? This is an organization of tens of thousands of people. Yeah. But for some reason, they have to pick this guy who insists on this method. And so clearly it's going to start an international incident. And so it's a pretty stupid thing to do. And it revolts not just Democrats, but Republicans too. I think in some way, you know, they weren't being that stupid because they assumed that they had impunity anywhere in the world. They could go kill anyone in the world and nobody would pursue them. Nobody would pursue this, you know, the investigation. And they weren't right about Washington because it was a car bomb, because it was in Washington. It was so high profile, and they also killed an American. But what also happened is that Letelier was a former ambassador, and as a former ambassador under U.S. law, that's considered a murder, right? You're a protected person by the U.S. government, and so it has to be investigated. Whereas if he was, you know, a visiting diplomat, it might be something else. Or if he was a minister visiting, it might be something, you know, they might not have investigated it. But there's two crimes committed there, and the FBI says, we don't care who did this or why they did it, right, or who the victim is, we have to investigate this. We have to find out the killers. And it's pretty hard for the White House to resist this, but I think the Chileans got the sense from the Nixon and Kissinger government and their treatment with kid gloves that they could get away with this. right? That Nixon and Kissinger wouldn't do anything, or the Ford and Kissinger, who was the government at the time in 1976, wouldn't really do anything about this.
Yeah, so I mean, my next question was going to be, you know, how could it be that the Chilean dictatorship didn't anticipate a negative reaction? And it, I think you were starting to get at it there, was that Nixon and Kissinger had really given them the impression that there were no consequences as long as they were fighting communists.
That's true. It gets even more specific on Letelier. About a month or two before Letelier is killed, Nixon has a conversation with Pinochet. And Pinochet twice names Letelier among a group of people who are becoming a thorn in his side. And he says, I wish you in America, you Kissinger, would do something about Letelier and folks like him, right? We're trying to neutralize them all over the world, and they're really causing problems for us. And Kissinger doesn't say anything. But, you know, he doesn't say, well, I hope you're not planning to, you know, commit any crimes in America. Of course, we'd have to punish this to the full extent of the law. He doesn't say anything like that. And of course, he's given signs throughout the years to Pinochet that Pinochet can do essentially what he wants, and Kissinger just wants it to be as quiet as possible, right? He's given those signs to people throughout South America, dictatorships throughout South America. And then shortly after this, there is a dispatch that leaves the, you know, Kissinger State Department, and it goes throughout all of the embassies of South America, because they know that embassies in South America are killing their opponents abroad, right? Not just in their, but abroad. So this is Operation Condor. And the message basically says, you know, we know you're doing this, and please stop doing it.
Right.
Yet, message is never delivered from these ambassadors to, right, to their counterparts in those countries. Because they basically say, no, we would, you know, we would burn all these bridges to Latin American dictatorships. We don't want to do that. And eventually Kissinger recalls the memo and says, never mind. And this is 5 days before the assassination. So there's simply no word coming from Washington, no warning against doing anything like this. It's almost a green light to go ahead and do it.
Yeah, and you know, it's it reminds me sort of a parallel in the sense that the message from the U.S., especially with Operation Condor, is you can do whatever you want outside your own borders as long as it stays inside Latin America. Because it reminded me of several years later with the Argentine invasion of the Islas Malvinas or the Falkland Islands, where they assumed that we have a good relationship with the Reagan administration and they're going to back us. But what they were doing is they were entering into something much bigger, which was the relationship between the United States and Great Britain. And that wasn't something Reagan was going to accept. And the same thing, we're not going to accept a bombing in D.C. So it's this over confidence by authoritarian governments about what the U.S. is going to back them on.
That's right. And also what's happening here, I mean, you're right, exactly right, that Reagan chose Thatcher, right? He chose Thatcher's side. And she was a far more important ally than the Argentine military. But what's also happening in the U.S. government, and I think Chileans assume that the U.S. president really controls the bureaucracy pretty closely, just like Pinochet controls the Chilean bureaucracy, right? And so he, you know, that the you know, a president of the United States who's an ally, whether it's Nixon or Ford or even Carter, will stop its FBI or its Department of Justice from truly investigating this case. And so they assume this sort of simplicity, right? And the U.S. government is much more complex than that. I mean, it's almost like there is a deep state that will do its job no matter what's going on, right? No matter what the politics, these guys will do their jobs. And in fact, that's sort of a core story of this book, is these sort of mid-level technocrats, right? These lawyers at the Justice Department, right? These assistant attorneys, these FBI agents, right? Folks who are, you know, they're anti-communist. They're mild, you know, they're kind of mildly liberal, but they're cops, right? Essentially, they're there to enforce the law. And so they see this crime. They say this is clearly a federal crime. We take it away from the Washington, D.C. police. And we're going to solve this sucker, you know. Plus, it's a high-profile crime. It's going to make us stars. And in fact, one of the early books that's written is written by right, the head assistant attorney, Gene Proper. Mm-hmm. And so he says, this is going to make my career. And he's exactly right. And he goes into the private sector after this. But I think he also really wants to solve this crime. And you also have these sort of mid-level diplomats, right? Not ambassadors necessarily, but sometimes ambassadors. Sometimes they're political attachés or that sort of thing. And they're really shocked that, you know, the Chileans would even think of doing this, right? Especially after they essentially supported the Chilean government in its overthrow of Allende. And now it comes back and does this. So they said, you know, we're going to solve this for sure. We're going to make somebody pay for this. And so there's a determination there. And sort of once those wheels are in motion, it's very difficult for any president of the United States to try and stop it.
Right. That's a good point. And thinking back to your comment earlier, so what was the long-term effect on U.S. policy toward Chile?
Well, one is that it's sort of, you know, it's got this sort of psychological effect that it creates this animosity for the regime that the regime has simply gone too far. It makes it appear that the United States doesn't control its allies, doesn't control the Cold War, and this is unacceptable, right? There is no actual impunity for U.S. allies, right? You can get punished for certain things. So that creates, you know, a division among a lot of U.S. diplomats and others who are dealing with Chile. And more, you've got people going to Chile at the embassy who are anti-Pinochet, who are pushing Pinochet to sort of show some progress on human rights. But more importantly, at the sort of political mechanism level, it's the Congress that is the key player here. Because in Congress, you have these liberal Democrats. One of the most important, right, there's Tom Harkin, there's Edward Kennedy, and they're probably the two most important ones on Chile. And what they do is that even during the Reagan administration, they allow Reagan to renew some aid to the Chileans, but only on the condition that Reagan certify several things, among them progress on human rights, and progress specifically on this case of Letelier and Moffitt. So that means if the Reagan government is not able to show substantial progress on Letelier and Moffitt, then he cannot sell weapons to the Chileans, can't have any military-to-military relationship. And of course, in the Cold War, that's the core of the relationship, right? If you don't have the military on your side, the military starts buying its weapons from elsewhere. They can buy them from the Soviets, from the Israelis, from the French, from the British. And America doesn't work that way in South America, right? All the weapons really should come from the United States. And so there's this constant pressure from the Reagan government, and eventually the CIA, the FBI, and others are, you know, really pressuring the courts to eventually put these people in jail, there's three Chileans who really are being accused, to put them through the system. And it doesn't work until Pinochet leaves, but it pushes the Reagan government to break with Pinochet in general. And so there's very little aid at all that goes to Pinochet. In fact, aid starts going to the opposition, which helps create momentum for the referendum and then the election that will eventually take Pinochet out of power by the late 1980s.
Yeah, because one thing over time as I had learned more about this that I hadn't really realized was that we make an assumption that the Reagan administration is deeply anti-communist, and so they were close supporters of Pinochet, and in fact that was never wholly true. And the sorts of things you're describing, there were schisms inside the administration saying this is too much of a pain in the ass, basically, and you know, this, we need to get this thorn in our side out of the way. And a lot of the hardliners, Haig and others, ended up on the sidelines. So it was really a wrench in the works in many ways for U.S.-Chilean bilateral relations when you should have expected them to be ideological allies.
That's right. And I mean, you know, if you read books like Pinochet and Reagan, you know, there's 8 years of Reagan, and there's a honeymoon with Pinochet for about 2 to 3 years, right? Yeah. By about 83, 84, things are really turning around. And Reagan is, you know, Reagan and, you know, people like Elliot Abrams, who are in charge of human rights, they're using Chile as a case where they're going to push for human rights. And they're going to do this as a counterbalance to pushing for human rights in Eastern Europe, right? Mm-hmm. Places like Poland and Hungary. They say, we can't just push for human rights in one area of the world. for us to look credible in the eyes of the world and to get the cooperation from, you know, the UN and so on, the OAS, we've got to push for it in both leftist regimes, right, under Soviet rule, and for rightist regimes. And since they have to do it with Pinochet anyways, right, they're bound by the Congress to do it, so they pick this case, right, more than another case, like they could have picked, you know, Argentina or Brazil or a Central American country, but they really picked Chile because Congress has pushed them into this position.
Yeah. Now, one thing we haven't talked about, but it's another really useful part of the book is the Chilean side. So we've talked about the quote unquote deep state in the United States, but we see the growth of a more independent judiciary in Chile as well. And so the question I wanted to end with is sort of taking the subtitle of the book. And so in what ways did the case really bring Pinochet's terror state to justice?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I tried to pick a subtitle that didn't exaggerate what I was arguing. I mean,
but it's got to be juicy. It has to be juicy enough.
That's right. It's got to grab attention, you know, but not be false.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully it does that. I mean, it shifts a lot of things within the Chilean government, but obviously it doesn't by itself take Pinochet down, right? The Chilean people are doing this through their movement for democracy, right? Which I would say it's partly inspired by Letelier and Moffat, but there are several specific things you can point to. Some come very early on. I mean, DINA, right, the secret police, is created, I think, in 74, and it's dismantled, I think, in 78, I think.
Yeah, I think it's 78.
Because of the first revelations that Chile is tied to the Letelier assassination, right? Once the FBI finds Michael Townley, that's the end of DINA. Mm-hmm. And so DINA's disbanded. So that regime of terror is over. DINA's responsible for half the deaths in the Chilean coup, right? And of course, for most of the terror after that, even though there's not that many deaths after the first several months, there is this regime of terror, and then DINA's gone. It turns into this other intelligence agency, and Contreras is taken out as the director. Mm-hmm. He becomes some sort of general in the army that has essentially no job. And then he retires shortly after. So so the case takes DINA and Contreras out of Chilean politics. That is huge. It helps free the press in Chile. The press was simply not free to report on human rights violations allegations in Chile during the Pinochet regime. However, because this case takes place in Washington and the original court cases take place in Washington, the press is essentially reporting on an American story, right? Mm-hmm. They're basically saying, well, this is what's going on in Washington. Everybody in the United States knows about this, so therefore we can put this on our front pages. And so the case loosens up the press to say, no, maybe there are other things going on in Chile. You know, maybe the stuff that we've been hearing about Chile from the left is actually true. So let's start reporting on that. At the same time, it loosens up another important player in democracy, which is the courts, right? There's constant pressure through this case to try to separate the civilian from the military courts. And as soon as the Pinochet government is done, there is a minister who comes in and says, yes, that's the priority, because the problem with the case is that it was often in these military courts. And in Chilean courts, it's the judges who do the investigating, right? It's not the attorneys. Mm-hmm. And so the judges are often really, you know, caught up in the system. They're involved. Often they're people who were in the Pinochet government when these crimes happened. So they're implicated in these crimes. And so they don't want to investigate them. But you have these new judges, you know, putting pressure on them. There's, you know, several times when the heat comes on from the State Department or the Pentagon against Pinochet, and Pinochet responds by loosening restrictions on human rights, right? Freeing some prisoners, freeing the press, lifting the state of emergency, right? And so there are some real consequences. He lets hundreds and then thousands of exiles come back into Chile, right? And one of them is actually Isabel Letelier, who goes back to try to get, you know, some legal standing for her husband in Chile. And so that is because of that case, right? Among other things, but mostly because of that case. And the most important thing really is what happens in the 1990s, right? Once Pinochet is actually out of power and then the case can proceed very quickly through the courts, the case itself inspires many because it's the first case in Latin America in which a violator of human rights goes to prison, right? A Cold War violator of human rights actually goes to prison. And that's Contreras in 1995. Now, I've given away the ending of the book, unfortunately. But that's the sort of ultimate importance of the case, and it inspires many, right, judges and activists to say, let's look back at these other cases that we weren't supposed to try and see if we can try them. And they find all sorts of creative ways of trying these new courts. And up to now, there have been about 1,000 of these successfully, right, tried courses in Chile, and Letelier was the very first one.
Yeah, and one of the most creative was to say that the amnesty that the military had imposed did not apply to the disappeared.
That's correct.
And that just blew it wide open.
Yeah, because the rationale is that since they were disappeared, we couldn't say they were dead yet, and therefore right. These were ongoing cases, right? The crime was ongoing after the amnesty. And the important thing about Letelier is that it was when they signed the amnesty law, Letelier was taken out of it. It was the sole exception to the amnesty law, and then it could be tried.
That's right.
Now, in a way, you can say, well, that doesn't help the cases under amnesty because it's a case that's an exception. But the very exception means that it's tried first, and therefore it inspires people to break the amnesty. So the amnesty law itself remains, but lawyers have sort of chipped at it from the edges so much that it basically doesn't have a lot of teeth anymore. And so you can try almost any case now from the past.
Right. Okay, well, we're out of time. I will say that it doesn't really matter if you're giving away a spoiler for the end of the book, you know, it's happened long enough ago. But the thing is that it's a good story. So that was why I enjoyed it, because you tell it's not your sort of a basic academic monograph. It's an actual story that I think someone who knows little to nothing about it would enjoy reading.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I wrote it as sort of a political thriller. You know, it's all true, but there's a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of action. There's interesting characters in there. And in fact, you know, you talk about these books in the early 1980s. Behind this was the fact that several Hollywood studios were interested in making a Letelier movie. People interested in making television shows about it. There have been movies and TV shows done in South America about these issues. And so maybe we'll see it pop up again, maybe as a Netflix miniseries or something like that. This next year's Narcos or something like that. But it'd be great because I think it is a fascinating story, and it's got a lot to tell us about democracy, human rights, counterterrorism, and not just Chile.
No, exactly. All right. Well, I've been talking to Alan McPherson, who's professor of history and director of the Center for the Study of Force and Diplomacy at Temple University. So go make sure you order his book. Again, it's Ghosts of Sheridan Circle, How a Washington Assassination Brought Pinochet's Terror State to Justice. Find him on Twitter. I saw you were doing a book signing somewhere. So there's ample opportunity to buy the book and possibly even see you.
Yes, I will be at Busboys and Poets in Washington, D.C. on October 1st.
There you go. All right, Alan, thank you so much for taking the time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.